This tape is produced and distributed by the Christian Biblical Church of God, Post Office Box 1442, Hollister, California 95024. This is number 5 in the series Scripturalism versus Judaism. And in this particular tape, I'm going to be reading just about the entire tape, excerpts from various books that we have researched for this particular project. In particularly, I'm going to be reading from the book The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah by Alfred Edersheim and Jerusalem in the Times of Jesus Jehoiachim Jeremias. And hopefully, if we have some time at the end, I will read some of the Sabbath laws of Judaism from the Code of Jewish Law, translated by Gans Frieden Golden. Just to let you know, some of the books that we are studying, I mentioned a couple of them, but I want to mention them again so that you'll realize that a lot of the things that we are covering have been published within the last 10 years, some of them within just the last, going back to 1990. And Carl Franklin has been in the forefront of finding these books for us. And let me just give you a little background on how we came to the knowledge of these books. When I finished writing the book, The Christian Passover, it became very obvious that we covered everything up to the time of Jesus Christ. And the question remained, what happened from the time of Jesus Christ through the destruction of the temple and on into the death of John and then on into the second century? And how did we get Judaism as we have it today on the one hand, and the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church as we have it on the other hand? How could two such divergent things take place? And because of that, we didn't realize that there were a lot of studies that were going on, that were taking place within the last 20 years, and some books that were published which covers the very area that we need. However, when I was reading and studying The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah by Edersheim, there were certain clues that I picked up on that we needed to look in and find out what was the historical background. Were there any books that could cover it? And those in particularly centered around Judaism and Hellenism and Egypt, in particularly Alexandrian Judaism. Also, we're covering the areas which then are Palestinian Judaism, which we will see is commonly called Eastern Judaism, while as Alexandrian Judaism or Hellenistic Judaism is called Western Judaism. However, we need to understand that all during that time, Hebrew was not, nor was Aramaic, the predominant language used in the Holy Land and in the area of the Roman Empire. It was Greek. We have a book here, The Documents from the Bar Kokhba Period in the Cave Leaflets, Greek Papyri, and this was published in 1989, which shows absolutely conclusively that Koine Greek was used as the common language, or as what is called the lingua franca, or the language of the people. In addition to that, Carl Franklin has the blessing of living close to the and James White Library, Andrews University, which is about 15 or 20 miles from where he lives. And he was able to get many good books which give us the time period which we are looking for, which 20 years ago we wouldn't have been able to cover. So what we're really doing in this, we are coming to understand how then the church became to be Catholic and the Jews became to be totally Pharisaical and the Eastern Judaism as we know it today. Here's a book that's entitled The Jews in Hellenistic and Roman Egypt, published in 1985, and this, by the way, is a Jewish publication. Here's another one by a Jew, which is entitled Christianity and Judaism, Two Covenants, by Kaufman, and this was published in 1988. So this is up to date. Here's another book that is also written by a Jew, which is Sholem, by Gershom G. Sholem, and it is entitled Kabbalah and Its Symbolism, which will be very good in giving us the understanding of Judaism, because you see, there are two branches of Judaism, Hellenistic Judaism and Babylonian Judaism, that is the Western and the Eastern forms of Judaism. Here is a book that was published in 1990 by Birger A. Pearson. It's entitled Gnosticism, Judaism, and Egyptian Christianity, Studies in Antiquity and Christianity, and that is going to be a very eye-opening book, and we'll get to it in subsequent sermons and readings. Here's another one that was published by the same man in the Studies of Antiquity and Christianity in 1986, entitled The Roots of Egyptian Christianity. Here's a book that was published in 1983 by a Jew, John G. Geiger, and it is entitled The Origins of Antisemitism, Attitudes Toward Judaism and in Pagan and Christian Antiquity, published by the Oxford Press. Then we have another one from a library that was close at hand. It was a Southwest Michigan library, Kalamazoo Library, which is the Jewish Historical Atlas, which then gives us many, many, many things concerning a summary of the history of Judaism all the way down to the present day. So we are going to be very thorough in what we're doing. We're going to cover everything in the way that it needs to be covered, and we're going to find out that it's absolutely essential for us to realize that true Christianity never had any foundational beginnings with Judaism. And that's why we've entitled this Scripturalism versus Judaism, because it is apparent in the Scriptures that the separation began immediately, beginning with John the Baptist. And all the teachings that we are learning in the New Testament are in a situation where that those who come into the church who are in Judaism must come out of Judaism. And they must strip away all the traditionalism which they had. And as a matter of fact, that's why Jesus, in bringing out, as we covered last time, in bringing out very clearly that he wasn't setting aside any of the law or any of the prophets, but he certainly was setting aside all of the traditionalism of the Jews. Now, let me begin reading from the book entitled The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah by Alfred Edersheim. And in this, and this has been published for a good number of years, and many people have read it. It has been a classic down through the time period. Let's get the exact date when it was first published. It was first published in September 1883, so the book is 110 years old, not this particular one that we have. And then in 1886, you had the second and third editions. In here, some very important things, and we're going to see some very interesting statements that he makes. So I'll just begin right in the preface, and I'll read through certain select sections that I have highlighted, which will be important for our study. And I want this to be thorough, and I want this to be ongoing. And I realize that there are a lot of you who cannot get this book, or a lot of you that it would be very difficult. It's well over 1,300 pages all told, pretty close to 1,500 pages. And so it is really quite a work. But he gives us certain clues here, and we're going to see particularly an admission that he makes, which in some ways is a little disturbing, but in other ways is very revealing. So I'm not going to give the page number or anything except to say that this includes a preface of the first edition, second, third edition, and all the way up through page 100 and, let me get that, 108. And I'll be reading various sections from this and hopefully get into the other book. It is indeed most true that Christ spoke not only to the Jews, to Palestine, and to that time, but of which history has given the evidence to all men to all times. We shall perceive that therefore in is holy of the times that are cast Jewish, while by the side of this similarity of form, there is not only essential differences, but absolute contrariety of substance and spirit, that is, between Judaism and scripturalism. Jesus spoke as truly a Jew to the Jews, but he spoke not as they spoke. No, not as their highest and best teachers would have spoken. And this contrariety of spirit with manifest similarity of form is, in my mind, one of the strongest evidences of the claims of Jesus, since it raises the all-important question, whence, or that is, from where, the teacher of Nazareth. In describing the traditionalism of the time of Christ, I must have said what I fear may, most unwillingly on my part, wound the feelings of some who still cling, if not to have faith of, yet to what now represents the ancient synagogue. In other words, he is politely saying in a roundabout way, some of these things are going to hurt some of those who believe in traditionalism. Yet it is not this disclaimer of traditionalism which not only explains the rejection of Jesus, but is the sole logical reason of the synagogue. Also, its condemnation. So, we have a situation here where it shows that Judaism is really between a rock and a hard place with Jesus Christ and the facts of the New Testament and traditionalism. Now continuing, in the New Testament, prophecies are not made to point to facts, but facts to point back to prophecies. The New Testament presents the fulfillment of all the prophecies rather than of prophecies, and individual predictions serve as finger posts to the great outstanding facts which mark where the roads met and parted. That is, where Christianity and Judaism met and parted. It leads up to this conclusion, that Jesus Christ was, alike in the fundamental direction of his teaching and his work, and in its details, antithetic to the synagogue, that is, going in totally opposite directions, antithetic to the synagogue in its doctrine, practice, and expectancies. James says in his preface to the second and the third editions concerning the one element which was not well received, which was anti-Semitism. He says, although I'm well convinced that a careful and impartial reader would not arrive at any such conclusion, that is, of anti-Semitism on his part, yet it was suggested that a perverse ingenuity might abuse certain statements and quotations for what in modern parlance are termed anti-Semitic purposes. And he said that there wasn't any thought on his part of doing that. However, we are going to see a statement here that he's also very protective of the modern Pharisaical Judaism, which he also must protect himself from, and that he deliberately does not give us certain things. This next statement, he admits that he's holding back some of the information because it would cause too much difficulty for the people who would then openly see what Judaism really was about. And much of that we now have in these other books, which I mentioned before we got started, which is that we're going to see that, in fact, Hellenistic Judaism out of Alexandria was the basis for what we know as the Catholic Church. Now, continuing here in the preface to the second and third edition, in truth, it has throughout been my aim to present not one or another isolated statement or aspect of Rabbinism, but its general teaching and tendency. In doing so, I have, however, purposely left aside certain passages which, while they might have most fully brought out the sad and strange extravagances to which Rabbinism would go, would have involved the unnecessary quotation of what is not only very painful in itself, but might have furnished an occasion to the enemies of Israel. So what he's saying is that he did not translate certain portions of the Talmud to bring out some of the true feelings that the Jews have toward other people, other religions. Now, we're going to pick up some things here, beginning in chapter 1. The Old Testament, which then is basically monotheistic, the strictest isolation was necessary, that is, of the Jews and their worship in the ancient world, in order to preserve the religion of the Old Testament from that mixture of foreign elements which would speedily have proved fatal to its existence. Civilization would necessarily influence them, render the continuance of their separation of a great importance as before. In this respect, even traditionalism had its mission and its use as a hedge around the law to render its infringement or modification impossible. And what actually happened was it destroyed the truth of the laws and commandments of God by all of the traditions that they had. Then he gives a little bit of the history of the Maccabees, a little background concerning Hebrew and Greek. He gives a background concerning the preeminence of the Babylonians. So let's read just a little bit here concerning the eastern and the western branches of the Jews. Hashem tells of the difference between the eastern Jews of the diaspora, and the western Jews being the Hellenist. And he says the differences between the Grecians and the Hebrews was far deeper than mere language and extended to the whole direction of thought. There were mental influences at work in the Greek world from which, in the nature of things, it was impossible even for Jews to withdraw themselves, and which, indeed, as it were necessary for the fulfillment of their mission is their isolation from heathenism and their connection with Jerusalem. At the same time, it was only natural that the Hellenists, placed as they were in the midst of the hostile element, should intensely wish to be Jews equal to their Eastern brethren. On the other hand, Pharisaism, in its pride of legal purity and a possession of the traditional lore with all that it involved, made no secret of its contempt for the Hellenist and openly declared the Grecian far inferior to the Babylonian dispersion. That such feelings and suspicions which they engendered had struck deep into the popular mind appears from the fact that even in the apostolic church, and that in her earliest days, disputes would break out between Hellenists and Hebrews, arising from suspicion of unkind or unfair dealings grounded on these sectional prejudices. Now, we need to understand that he is also siding with the Eastern Pharisaical Judaism, which survived down to this day as Judaism, and that he upholds the Babylonian schools as being better, and he also lays at the feet of the Hellenists certain difficulties and problems that the Jews had. Now, let's continue on here in understanding about Jewish writings and how they affect everything that they do, and then we will understand also what their writings do, how their tradition came about, and what effect it had. Now, in addition to the different commentaries and the things that they did after Ezra, he says, concerning the commentaries and scriptures, he says, from the onset, Jewish theology was divided into two branches, the Halakha and the Haggadah. The former, Halakha, means to go, was, so to speak, the rule of the spiritual road, and when fixed, had even greater authority than the scriptures of the Old Testament. Now, that is a very key to remember and understand in this whole thing concerning scripturalism and Judaism, is that they held that their traditions were of greater importance than the scriptures. Now, that's why when Jesus came and said, "Don't think I'm going to destroy the law or the prophets," he was showing that he was going to strip away all of this, the Halakha and the Haggadah, away from the scriptures of God. Now, continuing on, he says, and when fixed had a greater authority than the scripture of the Old Testament, since it explained and applied them. On the other hand, the Haggadah, which means to tell, was only the personal sayings of the teacher, more or less valuable according to his learning and popularity, or the authorities which he would quote in his support. Now, Remember when Jesus gave the Sermon on the Mount, that he spoke with authority and not as the scribes, because the scribes always used to quote someone else as their authority. Unlike the Halakha, the Haggadah had no absolute authority, either as to doctrinal practice or exegesis. But all the greater would be its popular influence, and all the more dangerous the doctrinal license it allowed. So what he's saying is that this kind of teaching allowed the traditions to take over and supersede the scriptures. In fact, strange as it may sound, almost all doctrinal teachings of the synagogue is to be derived from the Haggadah, which means that the sayings of the teacher, rather than out of scripture. He's admitting in a very roundabout way that Judaism does not follow scripture. Continuing now, he says, and this is also characteristic of Jewish traditionalism, but alike in Halakha and Haggadah, Palestine was under the deepest obligation to Babylonia. Now, continuing on, he says of the indebtedness and obligation to Babylonia, and concerning all Jewish religious leaders, even they had to acknowledge that when the law had fallen into oblivion, it was restored by Ezra of Babylon. When it was the second time forgotten, Hillel the Babylonian came and recovered it, and when a third time it fell into oblivion, Rabbi Chijah came from Babylon and gave it back once more. So what he's doing, he is showing how then the what we know as Eastern Pharisaism and what is commonly known as Judaism today came about with the influence from Babylon. So it is indeed one of the daughters of Babylon. For it is one of those strangely significant, almost symbolical facts in history that after the destruction of Jerusalem, the spiritual supremacy of Palestine passed to Babylonia, and the rabbinical Judaism, under the stress of political adversity, voluntarily transferred itself to the seats of Israel's ancient dispersion, as if to ratify by its act what the judgment of God had formally executed. Chapter 2, Edersheim explains concerning Western Judaism. And when we turn from the Jewish dispersion in the East to that in the West, we seem to breathe quite a different atmosphere. Despite their intense nationalism, all unconsciously to themselves, their mental characteristics and tendencies were in the opposite direction from those of their brethren, that is, in the East. With those of the East rested the future of Judaism, with those of the West, in a sense, that of the world. The one represented old Israel, groping back into the darkness of the past, the other young Israel, stretching forth its hands to where the dawn of the new day was about to break. These Jews of the West were known by the term Hellenists, and which means from Hellenized, who conformed to the language and manners of the Greeks. Whatever their religious and social isolation, it was, in the nature of things, impossible that the Jewish communities of the West should remain unaffected by the Grecian culture and mode of thought, just as, on the other hand, the Greek world, despite popular hatred and contempt of the higher classes, could not wholly withdraw itself from Jewish influences. Witness here the many converts to Judaism among the Gentiles. Witness also the evident preparedness of the lands of this dispersion for the new doctrine which was to come from Judea, that is, Christianity. Many causes contributed to render the Jews of the West accessible to Greek influences. They had not had a long history to look back upon, nor did they form a compact body like their brethren in the East. They were craftsmen, traders, merchants settled in for a time here and there, units which might combine into communities, but they could not form one people. Then their position was not favorable to the sway of traditionalism. Their occupations, the very reason for their being in this strange land, was purely secular. That lofty absorption of thought in life and the study of the law, written and oral, which characterized the East, was to them something in the dim, distant, sacred, like the soul and the institutions of Palestine, but unattainable. In Palestine or Babylonia, numerous influences from his earliest years, all that he saw and heard, the very force of the circumstances would tend to make an earnest Jew a disciple of the rabbis. In the West, it would lead him to Hellenize. It was, so to speak, in the air. He could no more shut his mind against Greek thought than he could withdraw his body from the atmospheric influences. That restless, searching, subtle Greek intellect would penetrate everywhere and flash its light into the innermost recesses of his home and synagogue. So these were the Hellenistic Jews, and the Hellenistic Jews then was the basis for the New Testament church, and also the basis from which later the Catholic Church was derived. And continues of this Grecian influence, such undoubtedly was the case. And yet, when the Jew stepped out of this narrow circle, which he had drawn around him, that is, in the confines of his synagogue, he was confronted on every side by Grecianism. It was in the forum, in the market, in the counting house, in the street, in all that he saw, all to whom he spoke. It was refined, it was elegant, it was profound, it was supremely attractive. He might resist, but he could not push it aside. Even in resisting, he had already yielded to it. For once it opened the door to the questions which it brought, if it were only to expel or repel them, he might give up that principle of simple authority on which traditionalism as a system rested. Hellenic criticism could not be silenced, nor could its searching light be extinguished by the breath of a rabbi. If he attempted this, the truth would not only be worsened before its enemies, but suffer detriment in his own eyes. He must meet argument with argument, and that not only for those who are without, but in order that he might be himself quite sure of what he believed. And he might be able to hold it not only in controversy with others where pride might bid him stand fast, but in that much more serious content within where a man meets the old adversary alone in the secret arena of his own mind and has to sustain the terrible hand-to-hand fight in which he is uncheered by outward help. In other words, he is saying very clearly that Hellenism and the Hellenistic world just penetrated deeply into the whole Jewish community and individual minds. So then the Hellenist, as a result of all of this, would seek to conciliate the truths of divine revelation with those others which he thought he recognized in Hellenism. In other words, those things which he saw in other pagan religions and philosophies, he sought to reconcile with the Old Testament. Now continuing, he says, on the other hand, there was the intellectual view of the scriptures, their philosophical understanding, the application of them, of the result of the Grecian thought and criticism, and this is what was particularly Hellenistic. What was Jewish, Palestinian, individual, concrete in the scriptures was only the outside, true in itself, but not the truth. There were depths beneath. And then he talks about stripping away all of these things to see that there are deeper truths in the Bible. But this deep symbolism was Pythagorean, this pre-existence of ideas which were the types of all outward, actually was Platonism. So what he's saying here is that the Jewish Hellenistic philosophy, which they developed themselves in Western Judaism, was actually based upon the philosophies of Plato. And we can't possibly understand the references to philosophy by Paul unless we understand the philosophical Judaism of Hellenistic Jews. Then he talks about the philosophies of the Greeks and some of the truth that they had, and even Paul agrees to some of the things there, that God revealed it to them, in, as he says in Romans, the first chapter, and he says of these grains of truth, which the philosophers were able to have, he calls them broken rays of light. Broken rays in them, but the focus of the truth in the Scripture. Yet these were rays, and could only have come from the sun. All truth was of God, hence theirs must have been of that origin. Then were the sages of the heathen also, in a sense, God taught, and God teaching, or inspiration, was rather a question of degree than of kind. So what happened in this, then the scriptures of the Old Testament became very Hellenized and very Grecianized from the point of view that the Greek philosophy was now intervening, and in so much so that we have the Greek Old Testament. So this was a very powerful thing which was happening. Continuing, Edersheim says, only one step remained, and that, if we imagine, if not the easiest yet, we, as we reflect upon it, that which in practice would be most readily taken. It was simply to advance toward Grecianism, frankly to recognize truth in the results of Greek thought. And then he explains quite a bit how this affected the Jews. There was the mighty spell which Greek philosophy exercised over all kindred minds, and the special adaptation of Jewish intellect to such subtle, if not deep, thinking. And in general, and more powerful than the rest, because penetrating everywhere, was the charm of Greek literature with its brilliancy, of Greek civilization and culture with their polish and attractiveness, and of what in one word we may call the time spirit, that Tyrannus. Tyrannus means it's a personification of the oppressiveness of the whole Greek thought, Greek civilization, Greek literature, Greek language, just like someone who was a tyrant. That's why it's called Tyrannus, who rules in all their thinking, speaking, doing, whether they know it or not. Why, its sway extended even to Palestine itself and was felt in the innermost circles of the most exclusive rabbinism. And then he talks about how even that Gamaliel II, who was a great Jewish patriarch, and that's the one from probably whom Paul had learned, as he mentions in the book of Acts, that this Gamaliel II also studied Greek philosophy, spoke Greek. So that's why it's an impossibility to say that Paul originally wrote everything in Aramaic, which some people like to say that it is so. But it isn't. It's very obvious from the historical facts here that we are covering. Then Edersheim talks about the influence of Greek literature even on those in Palestine, even working its way into some areas of what is called the Mishnah, and referred preeminently, if not exclusively, to the religious or semi-religious Jewish Hellenistic literature. So Jews were writing in Hellenistic Greek, outside even the Apocrypha. Now we need to understand that most of what are called the pseudepigraphical writings, that is, those apocryphal writings which are contained in the Greek Old Testament or the Septuagint, were written in Greek. Now continuing, but its occurrence proves at any rate that the Hellenists were credited with the study of Greek literature, and that through them, if not more directly, the Palestinians had become acquainted with it. Well, in fact, the truth was that Palestine was totally Hellenized. And then he continues talking about this Hellenization of Palestine. Its importance, not only to the Hellenists, but to the world at large, can be scarcely overestimated. First and foremost, we have here the Greek translation of the Old Testament, venerable not only as the oldest, but as that which at the time of Jesus held the place of our authorized version, that is, the King James today. And as such is so often, although freely, quoted in the New Testament. In other words, he's saying that the Septuagint was quoted in the New Testament. Nor need we wonder that it should have been the people's Bible, not merely for the Hellenist, but in Galilee and even in Judea. But most, if not all, at least in towns, would have understood the Greek version. It might be quoted in the intercourse with the Hellenistic brethren and with Gentiles, and what was perhaps equally, if not more important, it was the most readily procurable. So he's just saying that the Greek version of the Old Testament, which, by the way, was probably far more pure in its reliability and translation than the Septuagint we have today. And I just call your attention, if you don't know anything about the Septuagint at all, please read the preface and the introduction to it, and you will see that the version we have today has been corrupted substantially, so the great portions of it are not reliable for dogmatic doctrine. Then he shows how that the Greek Old Testament was reproduced with hundreds of slaves who were engaged in copying what one dictated. The result was not only the publication of as large editions as in our day, but their production at only about double the cost of what are known as our cheaper or people's editions. Accordingly, manuscripts in Greek and in Latin, although often incorrect, must have been easily obtainable and would have had considerable influence on the making of the Greek version of the Old Testament of the People's Bible. The Greek version, that is the Old Testament, like the Targum of the Palestinians, originated no doubt in the first place in a heartfelt national want on the part of Hellenists who as a body were ignorant of Hebrew. Hence we find notions of very early Greek versions of at least parts of the Pentateuch. But this, of course, would not suffice. On the other hand, there existed, as we may suppose, a natural curiosity on the part of students, especially in Alexandria, which had so large a Jewish population, to know the sacred books on which the religion and the history of Israel was founded. And so this is then the giving the background as to why the Septuagint originated and the need for it. Basically, it would be like today. If everyone in America was speaking English and the only Bible they had available to them was in German, naturally it would be translated into English so we could understand it. So in the same way, since Greek was so widely understood and read by everyone, the Old Testament was translated into Greek. And then we have the addition of the apocryphal books, which were also written in Greek. Now, he talks a little bit about Alexandria, and we'll cover considerably more concerning Alexandria because that is the key in understanding all of the difficulties and problems that we have and the foundation of the Catholic Church. In such manner, then, the Septuagint version became really the people's Bible to that large Jewish world through which Christianity was afterwards to address itself to mankind. It was part of the case that this translation should be regarded by the Hellenists, that is, Hellenistic Jews, as inspired like the original. Otherwise, it would have been impossible to make the final appeal to the very words of Greek, still less to find in them a mystical and allegorical meaning. Only that we must not regard their views of inspiration, except as applying to Moses, and even their only partial, as identical with ours. To their minds, inspiration differed quantitatively, not qualitatively, from what the rapt soul might at any time experience, so that even heathen philosophers might ultimately be regarded as at times inspired. So what is really being said here is that then this gives them license to go into the philosophies of the Greeks to understand some of the things that they considered inspired truth, which the pagan philosophers had. And so this then is the whole background which leads up to much of the apocryphal or pseudepigraphical writings, and also, as we will see later, leads much into the Jewish Gnosticism, then, which caused so much problem with the New Testament church. Not being in Edersheim. At any rate, we know that the Greek scriptures were authoritatively acknowledged in Palestine, and that the ordinary daily prayers might be said in Greek. The Septuagint deserved this distinction from its general faithfulness, at least in regard to the Pentateuch, and from its preservation of ancient doctrine. Now, the Septuagint was translated in about 270 B.C., so we see that this influence was over a long period of time, and when we put it in perspective of today's historical setting, we're looking at 300 years. So just take it back to 1693 as far as we are concerned with the beginning of what is called Hellenism. Now, continuing in chapter 3 of Edersheim, it says, the translation of the Old Testament into Greek may be regarded as the starting point of Hellenism. It rendered possible the hope that what in the original form had been confined to the few might be accessible to the world at large. And Edersheim talks about the apocryphal literature, which was always, for the most part, written in Greek. All of it was written in Greek, with the exception of possibly 1 Maccabees, Judith, and part of Baruch. But everything else was written in Greek. And it was a product of Hellenizing Jews. Now, one of the things it did beyond some of these apocryphal writings was to go beyond and to show what the next object was. Now, continuing with Edersheim, the next object was to show that the deeper and purer thinking of heathenism in its highest philosophy supported, nay, in some respects, was identical with the fundamental teachings of the Old Testament. This, of course, was apologetic of the Old Testament, but it also prepared the way for reconciliation with Greek philosophy. And then he shows exactly how many of these things came through the so-called apocryphal writings of the fourth book of Maccabees, the so-called book of wisdom, which was considered the wisdom was a revelation of God, which was written in Greek, but it was given to a Jew who wrote it, supposedly. And then it shows how they blended together Platonic, or that is the philosophy of Plato, with the other things of the Stoics. But the brilliancy of Plato's speculations would charm, while the stern self-abnegation of Stoicism would prove almost equally attractive. The one would show why they believed, the others why they lived as they did. Thus, the theology of the Old Testament would find a rational basis in the ontology of Philo and its ethics in the moral philosophy of the Stoics. And what we have today is that coming right on down through even the Babylonians into what is called Phariseeism today. This very Stoical kind of beat the flesh type of religion. Then Edersheim goes into quite a lengthy discussion of the pseudepigraphical literature, showing how that all the philosophies of the pagans were then blended into the thinking of how the Hellenistic Jews thought, and which then all came to be brought together as a complete system in the work of Philo. And Philo is really quite a noted person, a Jewish philosopher who lived on into the time of Jesus Christ. So many of his things are very important for us to understand in realizing all of the problems and difficulties associated with Alexandrian Judaism or Hellenistic Judaism. And so Philo was the one who brought all of this together. And he was the one to bring together the heathen philosophy and the faith of the Jews and to make it all one. And so then he was the one who went back and allegorized with the interpretation to things concerning the Bible and according to Hellenized Grecianism, what it meant. And he gives quite a long dissertation of everything of the Jewish thought of Philo and how that worked into all of the teachings then, which actually caused Western Judaism to be holy and absolutely separate and different from the Babylonian Eastern Judaism. Sheim says, Philo had no successor. In him, Hellenism had completed its cycle. Its message and its mission were ended. Henceforth, it needed, like Apollos, its great representative in the Christian church, two things, a baptism of John to the acknowledgement of sin and need, and to have the way of God more perfectly expounded. On the other hand, Eastern Judaism had entered with Hillel on a new stage. This direction led further and further away from that which the New Testament had taken in following up and unfolding the spiritual elements of the old. The development was incapable of transformation or renovation. It must go on to its final completion and be either true or swept away or destroyed. So he's showing the great conflict that there was. There was Western Judaism with Hellenism, with the Septuagint version of the Bible, had great influence into Palestine, into Jerusalem, into the inner circles of Rabbinism.